All right, before we begin, let's go ahead and have a prayer. Our merciful God and Father, we bow our heads this evening, thanking you for this day, thanking you for the rich blessings you have given us, and help us to be aware of them every day, to realize how much we have, that even life itself is a gift from you, and there is evidence of that on every hand. We're thankful for this time we have to gather together as Christians and study your word, and pray that our hearts will be open to what you have revealed to us. And I pray that as I lead this discussions this evening, that I will do so in a way that is helpful to each one of us, that our hearts will be open and exposed to what you would have them be, that we might better serve you each day. Mm-hmm. Help us to be good examples to those around us. Be with our brothers and sisters who are suffering various ailments. We're especially mindful of Joanne Moss at this time, and Patricia, who cares for her, and Bert King, and June Counts, and others. And I pray your blessings upon them. Help us to do what we can to aid them. These things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we're continuing our study in the miracles of Jesus. And if you have a lesson sheet in front of you, you see we're studying the healing of the man with the withered hand this evening. And this is miracles recorded in all three synoptic gospels, which is helpful, I think, in a way to get the entire scene of what takes place here before us. We really get a full picture of what transpires here. And I just want to remind us quickly of our theme for this study, and that is, who then is this? Who is this individual who does these wonderful works, these signs, these wonders, these mighty works? Is it just a man who was a good teacher, or is there something more to this individual? And I think the resounding response as we read and study is, this is much more than just a man. And tonight's lesson not only demonstrates Jesus' power over sickness and disease, I think it also demonstrates his miraculous knowledge into the hearts of men, as well as the fact that he is not just Lord and Savior, but he is Lord of the Sabbath. And we really learn a lot about what our attitude, or their attitude toward the Sabbath, should have been at that time. And we almost learn as much, if not more, about the scribes and Pharisees and their hearts through this miracle as we do about Jesus himself. And let us try to make sure that this lesson teaches us what our heart should be like as well. And as I studied this, I kept trying to think, what can I take out of this? What can I learn from what transpired here between Jesus and these men and this miracle? Let's go ahead and we'll just read Mark's account to begin. And we're going to be kind of looking at little bits and pieces from all the accounts, just trying to get the full picture. But Mark 3, 1 through 6. And he entered again into a synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they were watching him to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath, in order that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Rise and come forward." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill?" But they kept silent. And after looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately began taking counsel with the Herodians against him as to how they might destroy him. Lots said in this little passage here. And Luke really gives us the most detail in his gospel regarding where this was. And the first question I have on the sheet is, where did this miracle take place? Let's just take these one at a time. Where did this miracle take place?
Synagogue.
In a synagogue. And this isn't the first time we've seen Jesus in a synagogue performing a miracle. The other one was the demon-possessed man. What day of the week was it?
Saturday,
the Sabbath, yeah. And, Saturday is nothing to but the Sabbath is is a big deal, especially in that culture. And what was Jesus doing there?
He was teaching.
Yeah, that was his purpose, was there to teach. And as I was going to say, Luke gives us really the most detail in verse 6. And it came about on another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. So he was there teaching. Why did Jesus make a habit of preaching in the synagogues? That's not on your question sheet, but I know you know. Why was this a place he went to teach?
Was that his father's house or at?
That's where the Jews were at.
That was his father's house.
Okay.
You know, as he describes it, I must be about my father.
Yeah, and that's where the most receptive audience would have been, at least. You know, we think about that. If you want people who are anticipating the coming Messiah, who know the law, who know the prophets, that's the place you're going to find them. And that's where the most receptive audience should have been. Unfortunately, at times we find that's not the case, is it? In this case, this is not the most receptive audience. And I've thought about that. Sometimes I think the people who are going to be the most receptive to the gospel are the people who are the most religious. And a lot of times that's not the case. They're the people who are kind of set in their ways. They've got preconceived ideas about everything. And, you know, they're not going to, you know, they don't think they need anything. I think sometimes the most receptive people are the ones who recognize that they are in need, that they don't have all the bases covered. And we find that even in the Gospels, and Jesus with his relationship with especially the Jewish leaders. But Jesus was there that day for the purpose of teaching, and this miracle and the reason he performed it is perhaps one of the greatest lessons we can learn about the true purpose of the Sabbath to some extent. What is the context that Matthew gives for this miracle? If you read Matthew 12, 1 through 8, what do we see there? Yeah, the disciples are passing through a grain field, and they're plucking the grain and kind of getting a snack as they're passing through. And then what happens as a result of that? There's a conflict. With whom?
Pharisees.
And what do they say? It's not lawful for your disciples to do this. There must be some sound coming out of there. Okay. It's not lawful for your disciples to do this on the Sabbath. And whose synagogue was it, according to verse 9 of Matthew 12?
Their synagogue,
which would be whose?
Pharisees.
I think if you're reading the context of Matthew, I think it's the same Pharisees he had this conflict with. He entered their synagogue. Now, if you look at Luke's account, he says these things happened on two different Sabbaths. So I think the most logical explanation is that he had the conflict with these Pharisees the previous Sabbath, still in the same location, same town, which some believe is Capernaum. And then he has a conflict. Then he enters their synagogue the following Sabbath and is teaching. So there's already a relationship Jesus has with these scribes and Pharisees. Is there anything else in the context that makes us think there's a prior relationship here? Or that they know about something about Jesus?
They were already looking for a reason to accuse
him. Yeah. They've got their eyes open. They're checking him out. Is he gonna do this? And this will be one of the questions in just a moment. But they are watching him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. That's actually question 4. So now you know you have that answered if you didn't do it before. What specific detail does Luke give about this infirm man that is not in the other two gospel accounts? Did you get that?
Right.
Yeah, people were pointing around. Yeah, it was his right hand that was withered. And we'll get to that in just a second, but I'd like to talk about what it means to have a withered hand. And for years I've studied this, and I just assumed it was some kind of birth defect where the man's hand was kind of crippled and deformed and kind of all curled up like that. And we've seen people like that with limbs like that. But as I was studying, what I learned is that the tense of the Greek word translated withered here is the present perfect participle. And it indicates that, don't ask me, I mean, even as an English major, I don't have all that stuff down. it indicates that it had become withered. That's the verb. That this is something that was not from a birth defect, but an accident or a disease that happened during the course of time. And probably not just the hand, but the entire forearm, maybe from the elbow down. I think that's for the Greek word for hand, kind of actually even indicates that as well. So there was apparently a time when this man had the full use of his hand. But now, as a result of a disease or an accident, you know, he had lost the use of it. And it was obvious to everybody who was present there. They could see it. It was that deformed. The word withered is the same Greek word used to describe the seed that was sown beside the roadside in the parable of the sower. It sprung up, and then what happened? The sun came out and it withered away. It withered. And the Greek word actually indicates that it had no moisture left in it whatsoever. And you can almost see that. One of the commentaries I read said that there was years ago an apocryphal account that the Jewish Christians had of Jerome actually referred to it, that this man, the tradition was a mason and had lost the use of his arm. And you could almost see where an accident could have happened where it crushed the arm and perhaps crushed the arteries and then basically just dies on the man's arm. And here you've got this withered arm and hand. And I think that's really the description we have of what's going on here, that all the blood flow was lost to it and it basically died on his limb. And just an grotesque sight if you think about it. And I imagine there are medical situations, you know, especially in third world countries where things like that have probably even happened these days. But why might the right hand have any significance to it? I don't want to make a whole lot out of this, but...
labor for working?
Yeah, I mean, 90% of people, I had to look this up, but 90% of all people are right-handed. So more than likely, the chances are this was his dominant hand. So, and, you know, you can do some jobs with one hand, but not very effectively. And especially if you're a mason or something like that, it would probably be, you know, pretty much you're out of work at that point. Not that we know that's the case or not. So
interesting that it was Luke, the physician, who usually paid attention to detail as far as anatomical.
Yeah, and you know, I believe that we have everything written in the scriptures for a reason. You know, Jesus made, you know, arguments about the resurrection on the tense of a verb. So, you know, there's a reason Luke mentions it was his right hand. We may not know, but I wonder if that's the case. And we may come back to that before the class is over, at least at the end of class tonight. So we know that they were watching Jesus closely. Why were they watching him closely? So that they might accuse him, we're told in Mark 3 and verse 2. No, first of all, to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. First of all, to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. The motive was, we'll get to the motive in a minute. Why would it be a problem for Jesus to heal on the Sabbath? In these men's eyes, what was their thinking regarding that? I mean, I think we all know that.
Tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, so in their mind, healing on the Sabbath was equivalent to working on the Sabbath. And I think that the basically what they would say is that the only thing you could do on the Sabbath was work that was absolutely necessary. You know, to lift a fork to your mouth or something, to feed yourself or get some water or something like that. So in their mind, this was not absolutely necessary. So Jesus, if he did it, he was working. And Exodus 31:4 says that therefore you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. So they're thinking, if they catch him working the Sabbath, at least before the Jewish people, then they say he's guilty of death. And, you know, we'll see how they respond to this at the very end. And we kind of see this idea about, you know, if it's not absolutely necessary. There's another instance where Jesus heals on the Sabbath, and the synagogue official says, aren't there 6 days a week in which you can come and be healed? You know, this isn't necessary to do it today. You need to do it, you know, on Monday or Sunday or whatever else it might be. It doesn't have to be done today. And that's kind of the, you know, that's where that came from. That, you know, this isn't an absolute necessary thing. It's so, and they classified it as work. Essentially, and Frank really kind of touched on this, what had these men done with God's law concerning the Sabbath? Yeah, they added their own rules and restrictions and traditions, regulations to it. And there were a litany of things that they made up that you know, and perhaps the initial idea of this was the motive was good. It was like, let's make sure we don't violate the Sabbath. You know, we always hear of a Sabbath day's journey. The law does not talk about how far a Sabbath day's journey is. But they had a Sabbath day's journey. So, and they said, well, we need to know how far it is so we don't violate the Sabbath. And then they would measure it out and put markings out beyond their house about how far they could go without violating the Sabbath. They had I heard or read somewhere that they actually had a law that said how far you could throw a rock on the Sabbath and it not be work. But then you got a problem there. Do you count where the rock hits, or do you count how when it bounced, the bounce and roll? So, I mean, that's, you know, but they actually debated these sort of things. But they, as what did Jesus say? They built what? Hedges around the law. You know, and then what happened to those hedges, those traditions? They actually became as important as the law itself. And that's exactly what we see happening here. So they're watching Jesus closely to see if he would violate what they taught was the law concerning the Sabbath. You know, they just had a conflict with him about his disciples plucking grain. It's one thing for the disciples to be violating the Sabbath, but hey, if we can get the ringleader doing it, we've got him. Yes, Ken.
Well, and the concept of it was wrong. Jesus tells them, you know, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath.
And that's really the whole point of what he teaches here, is that they had it all upside down. And we'll talk about that as we get into this a little bit further. What do all three gospel accounts say was their motive for watching him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath? So that they could accuse him. Their hearts were not in the right place from the beginning.
They
weren't interested in knowing Jesus or hearing him teach. They were interested in accusing him, of tripping him up, of finding something they could use to really destroy him, ultimately, is what we're told here. But it really gives us insights into their true heart. In Mark's account, it specifically tells us, it says, there was a man there with a withered hand, and they were watching Jesus to see if he would heal him. What does that tell you right there, first of all? They knew the man was there. And possibly, you know, would that man have been in the Sabbath in the synagogue on that day otherwise? You know, this could be a setup. You know, here's this man with it have to be with this grossly deformed hand in the midst of everybody. And they're watching Jesus to see if he would heal him. You know, that they may have invited him there, paid him off even. We don't know that, but it's just the way Mark says it makes me, they're watching to see if Jesus would heal this particular, not to see if he would heal, but to see if he would heal this man. And Brian called me on this as he came in the building this evening. So according to Luke, what is the unseen miracle that occurred on this occasion? If you believe it's a miracle.
Yeah, but Jesus knew what they were thinking.
Yeah.
That's not really.
Okay, that's what Brian was saying.
Yeah.
Do you think Jesus knew what they were thinking?
Yes.
Yeah, we're told in John chapter 2 that he knew all men. I believe it is that this is miraculous knowledge, that Jesus knew what people were thinking. He knew what they were going to say. He knew what they were going to do. I mean, this is, who is Jesus? Emmanuel, God with us. God's all-knowing. And I believe, I believe Jesus was all-knowing. He knew all these things, or could know them. Ray.
How prevalent were miracles happening at this time? Because it's amazing that their mind is so clouded that it's not even a wondrous thing to them. Their hatred for him is so strong.
We're going to talk about that a little bit in the end. But yeah, I think you're exactly right. That how can they not understand what happens here and who this is? But we can ask that question over and over again, can't we? Because they say there's no doubt that a notable miracle has been performed, they said. You know, Nicodemus got it. He's the one that said, nobody can do the things you do unless God is with him. He accepted it. His heart was open enough to understand that, but these men are not doing that. And one thing I want, you know, this is not a battle of wits here between Jesus and these Pharisees. He's not there trying to trip them up or trying to one-up them. That's not his goal, and I think we need to see these men are possibly even planting this crippled man here in front of him and try to catch him in a trap. And Jesus knows exactly what they're up to. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He knows what they're trying to do. And the fleshly part of me reads these accounts and it says, get them. You know, just you put them in their place. Show them what's going on here. But that's really not his desire. I think we need to recognize it. That's not his motive. It wasn't to shame them. It wasn't to make them look bad. They didn't need his help for that, really, did they? I mean, we don't either, for that matter. His primary motive was to try to get them to see that they were mistaken in their interpretation of the Sabbath law, that they were not being merciful toward this. That was his desire for these men. He wasn't just trying to make them look bad. He wanted them to see what their attitude should have been. That how far off base they were in their understanding of the Sabbath. And he wanted them to understand that and everybody else who was present. It makes me think of what he says in Matthew 23 and 37. After he has basically castigated the Pharisees, you know, and just, you know, talks about all these things. And then he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I longed to bring you into my arms like a mother hen brings her children. But what does he say? But you would not. You would not listen. And I think that's it. He wants them to come to the understanding of the truth. But they're obstinate. They're stubborn. Their hearts are not where they need to be. And I think that is the problem. He's not there just trying to make them look bad. He's trying to teach them, and they're not listening. And of course, he knows that the word of God cannot penetrate our hearts if we are unwilling to allow it to do so. And these men were not allowing it, unfortunately, to do that on that occasion.
And they didn't seem to care about the man with the withered hand. In other words, if they had put themselves in his place, you know, and they had the withered hand, they surely would have wanted Jesus to heal them if it had been them. But because it was someone else, they didn't even show mercy or compassion on him.
Yeah, and he talks about their hardness of their hearts. And I think that's exactly what it's talking about. In Mark's, let's go to this, question number 7. According to Matthew, what question did the scribes and Pharisees ask of Jesus? What is the question they asked of him?
Lawful to heal on the Sabbath.
Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Now, in Mark's and Luke's account, we're told Jesus asked a question of them, which is what? To save a life or to kill? Luke says to save a life or destroy. So which one of them asked the question? Is this a contradiction? Is this, somebody got it wrong. It was actually they, not Jesus. I actually think they asked the question first. I mean, I think that's what happened here. And it's really interesting. So here they've got this guy here with a withered hand. They know he's there. And Jesus is not taking the initiative. He's not doing anything. So what do? Well, hey, what do you think? Is it okay to heal on the Sabbath? Sort of thing. They're really baiting him, aren't they? And then notice, I think it's question number, what does Jesus do before he asks the question? He says, yeah, look at what we're told in
Rise and come forward.
So before they ask him the question, and here's the way this kind of plays out. They ask him the question, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And Jesus says, you rise and come forward in front. And apparently he was sitting down. So more than likely, you know, everybody's sitting down on the floor in the synagogue. I don't think they had chairs back then. They might have had pillows or something. I don't know. So this man rises up in front of the entire synagogue, comes forward. And then when he gets down front, Jesus asks his question. You know, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill it? And then we'll get to the other part of that question in a minute. And, you know, Jesus is really turning the question around back on them, isn't he? They're asking the question, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And he's saying, here's what you're really asking me. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill it on the Sabbath? That's what you're asking me, Neil.
I will see this as him comparing himself to them with that question. Is it lawful to heal or to do harm? His intention was to heal. Their intention was to do harm.
And I think that he's trying. He's setting it all. He said, "You're asking a question if it's lawful to heal," and I think you're right, Neil. He's saying, "Yeah, is it lawful to do good, or is it lawful to do bad, or to save a life, or to destroy it?"
Both he was pointing out both things that were going wrong. They didn't think anything was what they were doing was being understood or seen.
No, and they didn't even understand, I don't think, what he was saying for the most part. But what he proceeds to teach them here is that this is not a question regarding keeping the Sabbath. It's really a question about what is right and what is wrong. And I think that's there's a quote from the pulpit commentary, I thought, that really said it well. It says, the sum and substance of the master's teaching here is works of love done for the bodies and souls of men, never mar or in any way interfere with the holiness of a day of rest. So they're saying that this commandment to keep the Sabbath, I mean, that's there's nothing that trumps that. That's kind of how the Pharisees looked at it. This is God's law, and it says keep it. So no matter what, it doesn't matter what's going on. And Jesus is saying, no, you're missing the point. That if you have the opportunity to do good for somebody and you don't do it, then you're violating the Sabbath. Really, I think is the point he's making. The Sabbath, as Ken was saying, was always for the benefit of man. It was never intended to take precedence over the principle of doing what is right and good and merciful. None of God's laws are that way. And you know, when you think about this, I think the coronavirus is kind of, all this happened in the last months has helped us to understand that a little bit. We are commanded not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, aren't we? That's Hebrews 10:25, I believe, is the passage. I think that's it. How many of us didn't assemble for a number of months? I mean, did we violate that commandment? Didn't we violate God's law of not forsaking our assembling together? Well, if our assembling together was potentially harmful to somebody, potentially caused someone to get sick and die, even to our neighbors, then what does that say about it? Is that doing good or is that doing evil? You know, so if our assembling together is going to result in somebody you know, being harmed, then we shouldn't be doing that. And it's about mercy, and I think that's the whole point Jesus is making here. So, yeah, did we sin by forsaking our assembling? We weren't forsaking our assembling. If we could have been here, we would have been here. And I think that's the whole point of the Sabbath. The Sabbath law was not that you just, you know, well, if you want to break it, that's you know, no big deal. It doesn't matter at all. No. That's why you got stoned, if you just disregarded what God said. But, you know, Jesus points out a number of things. You know, how, you know, you circumcise a child on the eighth day if it's on the Sabbath. Why? Because that's part of the law as well. You know, we do it all the time. What if a mother has a sick child at home? Does she stay home with that child, or does she leave the child there and come to church and not forsake the assembly? You know, we see that principle, and I think that's what we're seeing here. That if you have an obligation or opportunity that you need to be doing good, then you've got to understand that God never wanted his law to get in the way of doing what's right in that sense. Does that make sense to everybody? Les?
Well, I just had a thought passing thought that the ultimate irony of their disposition towards Jesus and desire to destroy him as it relates to the Sabbath was they did eventually crucify him. And in order to not defame the Sabbath, had him taken down from the cross just in time. So that they did, after killing the Son of God, then they take him down so that they're not defiled on the Sabbath.
Yeah, because it was the day of preparation. Yes. Exactly. And that's where their hearts were. And they're totally missing the point of God's law and the purpose of why he has us do things. It was God's law was never intended to give us an excuse not to do what is morally right and good. And that's kind of what the Pharisees did occasionally, didn't they? What did Jesus say? That there were some who weren't taking care of their obligations to their parents, and what was their excuse? It was Corban. It was dedicated, oh, I can't help you because I've given all my money to God. So I don't have to spend any more money on taking care of my parents. They're using God's law as an excuse to do evil, really. And in a sense, that's what they're doing. They're doing evil to this man who is in need because they've got an agenda they're trying to put forth. So Jesus asked this question, you know, is it lawful to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath? And what he asked this man to come forward before he asked the question. And then in Matthew's account, what analogy does Jesus use to demonstrate their hypocrisy here? Let's go ahead and read that. Matthew 12:11. These are really small verses on this piece of paper. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and read the whole question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath in order to... what man shall be there among you who shall have one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? So then, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? And what was their answer?
Well, Jesus said it is lawful.
Yeah, well, he's asking the question, is it lawful to do good on the... But how did they answer him? I think it actually says in Mark's account, Mark 3 and verse 4, but they kept silent. And I've got the question a little bit wrong in question 10. I said, what was Jesus' demeanor as he asked them this question? I think it's after he asked them this question. What was his demeanor? He was angry. Yeah, first thing he says, and after looking around at them with anger, and Luke actually adds, he looked around at all of them. So he has this man come forward, and then he asks this question, and they don't answer it. And then he looks around at all of them, all these Pharisees and scribes who are looking to accuse him, who are looking to, you know, use this man, really, in this, you know, in this pitiable condition to try to forward their agenda. And he looks at them with anger. There are two occasions, I believe, in the New Testament where it says Jesus was angry. This is one of them. Anyone remember what the other one is? The money changers. And I think really in both cases, God was being dishonored. His temple was being profaned. In the case of the money changers, they were using it for the wrong purpose. And the Sabbath is really being profaned here. They were using it and seeing it for the wrong purpose. The only two times, I believe, where it's mentioned that Jesus was angry. And it says he looked around at them in anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. He's not just angry with them. He's angry at their sin, but he's grieved that they refuse to see themselves for who they are. He's grieved that they're rejecting him. Really, the promise of the law that they have been looking for, and they're rejecting him. They aren't even giving him a chance. And he's grieved because he's their only solution. And I think, you know, he is angry as he is at them, he feels compassion for it. That grieved. That's what it says when God told Abraham to cast Ishmael and Hagar away. It says Abram was grieved. And I think he's just raised this boy till 12 or 13 years old. It's his son by birth. I mean, it's just as much as Isaac was his son, and he's grieved that he has to send him away. And Jesus is grieved in this situation because of these men. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, that they're not seeing it. And Micah 6:8 occurred to me, and we know this passage, maybe not by location. But what does the Lord require of you? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Is that what we see these men doing here? No, this isn't just. This isn't kind. This isn't even walking with God. Neil?
Start off here. It says that Jesus went to the synagogue. The leaders of the Jewish people in that city. The synagogue wasn't a place to go learn. It was a men's club where they could go plan, connive, strut, and try to centralize authority and power in themselves.
Pat themselves on the back, so to speak, as well.
And show, be able to show their peers, or not their peers, but the fellow Jews, who was important. And it wasn't about looking for a Christ. It was looking for someone that they could manipulate, control, buddy up with, and gain more power.
And their primary goal was to see how religious they could look and what people would think of them and things like, you know, they broaden their phylacteries and, you know, the hems of their garments and all these other things to draw attention to themselves. What Ray brought this up, but what was it that made these men so blind to who Jesus was here?
The same thing that makes so-called theologians today blind to God's word.
Yeah, the ones who try to justify the miracles is not really happening. We were talking about that the other day, and you know that this miracle didn't really happen. You know, that was the shallow water. He was walking on stones or things such as that. It's pride. It's sin. It's all of these things that because people have their agendas, and accepting Jesus for who he is going to throw us off our agenda.
Did they look at themselves as being evil? You think their perception of themselves?
Oh, of course not. No. I mean, look at the Pharisee and the publican. Lord, I thank you I'm not like this guy over here. You know, they might have said, I thank you I don't have a withered hand like this guy over here. You know, I think, you know, that they could have even said, you know, and what did they think deformities and accidents and things were the result of? Typical sin. Yeah, this guy's a sinner. You know, why would we even, you know, want him healed anyway? He's done something to deserve this. And I've got question 11. I don't know if I want to, I didn't write this question with anything specific in mind. I just, as I was reading the passage, I was saying, can you think of any way in which we might be guilty of demonstrating a similar hardness of heart as these men?
Well, I just thought, well, when we don't follow the command of Jesus, we're just, you know, wanting to do things our way, along to ourselves almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think we get sometimes so focused on the minute things that we forget. Go ahead, Lester.
Yeah, I was thinking sometimes things that are required of us or someone needs something at an inconvenient time for us. I'll give you a quick case in point that I'm kind of proud of saying. Y'all may have seen on the news where there was a house that was burned in Candler. Well, Sadie happened to be going by, it's only two doors down from our house, and she was on her way to take a mask to Mary Ellen, who needed to work, and she had forgotten the mask that she had because they required it there for the checkouts at Ingles. But at any rate, so that's where she was going. But there was this huge explosion, and she saw a lady coming out of that house that was on fire, and she stopped. In other words, that wasn't what she was planning to do, but she stopped there and went over to, and with another lady's help, the next door, they got the lady out and pulled her way out into the yard. But I thought, you know, well, that was showed good character, because she was aiming to go somewhere else that, and Mary Ellen needed her, but this took priority.
Yeah, what if she was on her way to church?
Yeah.
I can't stop. I got to be at church this morning. I mean, that's, you know, but we've got, you know, have we ever cut anybody off trying to be on time at church or thing? I mean, there are things like that. Or have we been so concerned about winning an argument with somebody about the Bible that we've lost the spirit of Christ in doing that? And there are things that we can do that can be very much like this. We've all got to be very careful about that. We haven't gotten to the miracle yet, so I really want you know, not get there, but let's see. Let's go ahead and read, and we'll look at. So Jesus has this man come down before him, and he asks this question, and then he said to the man, in Matthew's account, "Stretch out your hand," and he stretched it out, and it was restored to normal like the other. I mean, this is God in the flesh who performed this, who can bring something that is dead back to life. And he did this before their very eyes, and they didn't see it. They didn't recognize who he was. And what does it say that they did after this? Who did they take counsel with, first of all? The Herodians. I mean, these are their natural enemies. These are the ones who support Herod and his policies and politics. And they were enemies, but they took, and what did they want to do?
Destroy.
They wanted to destroy him. You know, and we might find that peculiar, but how many people want to destroy Jesus today in his influence? I mean, we see it all the time, don't we? They want to deny these miracles. They want to deny the inspiration of Scripture. They want it because why? Because by accepting it, then they have to acknowledge who they are and that their lives need to be changed and bring their lives in compliance with who God is. And that's, these Pharisees were not willing to do that. We see that over and over again. But it shouldn't surprise us that they wanted to destroy him, because that's been going on ever since, that people have tried to destroy Jesus. So that's the class for this evening. Thank you for your kind attention, your good comments.